Is America doomed? A scary question, but one many Americans are asking. What would the Founding Fathers say about all this? From WAMU and NPR in Washington, this is 1A. Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson. Today on 1A, Rethinking the Republic. Carl Sandburg wrote, "The Republic is a dream." These days it can feel like a nightmare. Partisan gridlock, political bickering, a citizenry that some say is more divided than ever. Pretty deep messes. But how can we get out of them? How much should we look to the founders for guidance, if at all? And if this is not the republic you want, what do you want?
American exceptionalism is that we are exceptional because we are an idea open to all.
That's just ahead on 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Cleveland Clinic. It's been 2 billion, 100 million heartbeats since Cleveland Clinic performed the world's first modern coronary bypass surgery, which is just one of the reasons Cleveland Clinic has been ranked number one in heart care in the nation for 24 years, according to U.S. News and World Report. But it doesn't stop there. New cardiovascular innovations are always being developed and tested at Cleveland Clinic. For more information or to get a second opinion, visit clevelandclinic.org/heartcare.
The categories of left and right divide our world.
Exit left.
All the left-handed people.
Left-wing extremism.
A right-wing group.
Far right.
Exit right.
These categories also apply to our brains. How the left and right hemispheres shape our view of the world. This week on Hidden Brain.
Do you ever look at America today and ask yourself, what the hell is going on? If so, don't worry. The Founding Fathers saw this coming, including Benjamin Franklin. History records that Franklin was leaving Independence Hall in Philadelphia on the Constitutional Convention's last day. A woman asked him, "Well, doctor, what have we got? A republic or a monarchy?" To which he famously replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." Merriam-Webster defines republic as a government in which supreme power resides in a body of citizens entitled to vote and is exercised by elected officers and representatives responsible to them and governing according to law. Supreme power in the citizens, in us. Representatives who are responsible to us. Government according to law. So how's that republic working for you these days? What's not working? And how can we ensure that we will keep this republic, if it's not too late? Joining us are two authors with different ideas about our democracy. Here in studio is Michael Tomasky, the author of If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. He's also the editor-in-chief of Democracy Journal and a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Michael, welcome to 1A.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Joining us via Skype from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania is Eric Metaxas. He's the author of If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty, and he's also the host of the nationally syndicated Eric Metaxas Show. Eric, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let me go back and forth between the two of you for the beginning and just kind of get the basics of your premise. Eric, the title of your book, the subtitle rather, is The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. What is that forgotten promise exactly?
Well, I just have to say the book, If You Can Keep It, when I discovered what I write about in the book, I was myself staggered. I had a good public school education in Connecticut. I went to Yale University. I was an English major. But it wasn't until the last five or so years that I discovered that what the founders thought utterly necessary to the keeping of the republic. And when I say the founders, I mean every single one of the founders, not a little group, a faction. What they believed was vital, necessary, not optional, has no longer been taught in America, let's say in 50 years. So when I discovered, I thought, oh my goodness, if America is an idea, we're not an ethnic group, we're not a tribal group, we are an idea. And the founders said that in order to keep it, and Franklin at the head of the pack, he said, we must keep it, we must know how it works, what our job is to govern ourselves. To govern yourself means you won't be governed by a big bureaucracy. You won't be governed by a tyrant or a dictator or a king. And I thought to myself, I've got to get the word out, because as you said in your introduction, we are clearly at a critical pass in this nation.
Indeed we are, Eric, and I hate to cut you short. I want to make sure that I get Michael into the debate as quickly as possible. So to the subtitle of your book, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty, what is the forgotten promise?
Well, I think at the center of it is what I call American exceptionalism, except we have a funny idea about that. American exceptionalism is that we are exceptional because we are an idea open to all. In other words, my parents who speak with accents can become as American as George Washington if they buy into these ideas. So we're supposed to be outward focused. And when we say things like make America great again, it has to be said in a way that presupposes we want to be great and strong because we want to bless the rest of the world. We want to share our freedom with the whole world. John Winthrop says that in his speech, you know, when he says we're shining, we want to be a shining city on a hill. Mm-hmm. The point is we're supposed to be outward focused the way the Statue of Liberty is facing outward with the torch of liberty. That's a fundamental idea that the founders baked into the whole thing, and we don't talk about that.
Michael Tomasky, the subtitle of your book is How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. How did the Republic collapse as you see it? And for that matter, how and when did the Republic collapse?
When? Well, you know, you could argue that it's still in present tense collapsing slowly around us. My book is a book about political polarization, and it's a political and cultural and economic history of polarization. And it goes back to the Constitutional Convention in the early days of the Republic, trying to show readers that we have been polarized since the very beginning. The people might think that this started in the 1990s with Gingrich and the Clintons. Well, it started in the 90s, but the 1790s. And there's a long, long history. However, I would argue, and I say in the book, that in the 20th century, from the Depression through the World War II and into the post-war era, we were achieving a kind of consensus that was providing general prosperity for all, and that was slowly, with great difficulty, but was extending the promise of American life to everyone. This wasn't so good for African Americans and women in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but we started to take on those battles in the 60s, and we started to spread equal rights and distribute that good for everyone. So we started, we fulfilled the meaning of the word republic. We were in a phase where we were fulfilling the meaning of that word in terms of rights and in terms of general prosperity. And I argue since the 70s, 80s, we've been retreating from those promises on both of those fronts.
That kind of touches on a comment we got from Kat, who wrote on our Facebook page, "I am related to James Madison, but I see all of the founding fathers as humans that were products of their time. Yes, they were intelligent men who were what we needed as a nation. However, they were human, and the rules they created left out people of color and women, yes, and so many other things they never knew would exist. Democracy is a moving target. If we cling to the past, we will lose touch with their plans for us as we conform it to our modern reality." We're speaking to Michael Tomasky, the author of If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved, and Eric Metaxas, the author of If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. Eric, what is your sense of how we should be viewing the founding fathers as we go forward through this discussion? Michael, I want you to answer the same thing too, but you know, we laud the founding fathers for a lot of things, not the least of which being starting the United States, which I think is pretty cool, but how should we view the founding fathers in the context of today, in your view, Eric?
Well, I think it's become too fashionable to look down on them and to decry their being men and white men, and some of them slaveholders. You know, that's become very trendy. And I think we have to be really careful because historically speaking, just as, you know, we want to pat ourselves on the back that we understand slavery is unacceptable, they ought to be patted on the back for giving us the promise of abolishing slavery, the promise in what they put in all those documents that we never had to really say, oh, this document is wrong. In effect, they gave us the possibility of eradicating slavery, of eradicating institutional racism through Jim Crow laws. They gave us the ability to give women the vote. I think the problem is that we no longer celebrate. We've gotten into this downward death spiral where we can only see the flaws. And it's like if you have a kid and you tell that kid, you're bad, you're never going to amount to anything. It's institutional. It's baked into you. It's your father's genes. You'll always be bad. We've kind of done that with America since the 60s. It's really healthy to identify our problems, but only if we sort of, you know, to use like an old-fashioned word, we repent of our problems. We say racism was a sin. We need to repent. We need to do what we can. But then we need to celebrate how to move forward. We need to pat ourselves on the back and say, we had a war where hundreds of thousands of white men died so that we could win, keep the Union together, abolish slavery. We need to really, in a sense, give ourselves those pats on the back and give the founders pats on the back for giving us the possibility of moving beyond our original sins.
Michael, what's your view on how we should be on the perspective we should keep of the founders today before we have to pause?
Yeah, I agree a lot with the emailer you quoted earlier. Look, they were visionaries. They were great. They came up with an incredible thing in their day, a constitutional democratic republic, first one in history. Bravo. But let's be clear about its flaws, and let's be clear about the process by which they arrived at that end. You know, we kind of are taught in school that they were geniuses and that this was some miraculous process, and almost as if these tablets with the Constitution written on them were handed down on Mount Sinai, sort of. It wasn't that way. It was a dirty scrum. It was a really political process. They fought. They argued. They took very difficult votes. They disagreed vehemently. The Connecticut Compromise, which created the United States Senate, which a lot of people say today is extremely undemocratic, and I'm one of them, passed by one vote, 5-4-1. And New York wasn't there that day, so there's been debate over the centuries about how New York would have voted. But anyway, it was a political process, and we should recognize it for what it was. It was politics, just like politics today.
There are some other political processes of the past that some of our listeners are asking about. Michael emailed, "Can someone please explain how the role and presence of the Electoral College in our electoral process is consistent with or supports the definition of a republic read at the beginning of the segment?" Good question. We may put that to Michael Tomasky and Eric Metaxas as our conversation continues. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice, and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states, and LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Squarespace founder Anthony Casalena came up with the idea for a better website publishing tool in his college dorm room, and since then, built it into a company valued at $1.7 billion.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the state of our democracy and whether we can keep this republic with authors Michael Tomasky and Eric Metaxas. Michael is the author of If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. Eric's book is called If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty. Eric is also the host of the nationally syndicated Eric Metaxas Show. And Michael is editor-in-chief of Democracy Journal and a special correspondent to Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Let me get to a few of your comments. Steve tweeted, "With civilizations, the larger they become, the more difficult it is to hold them together. As Franklin noted, identity politics is speeding our erosion as subsections condemn other subsections of our population." Matt's Doing Things tweeted, "The founding fathers' wants for this country should be taken with a grain of sand. These were people from 200 years ago that didn't even know dinosaurs or germs were a thing." Amy tweeted, "I'm still baffled. I've read the Constitution. To me, it's clearly a living document designed with room for change. Otherwise, the Founding Fathers wouldn't have made the Bill of Rights. We also got a number of voicemails from you, including this one that landed in our inbox.
Hi, this is James from Fort Mill, and I think that we're failing as a republic because everyone seems focused on the presidential election, but they're not focused on their local and state governments. That's the ones that truly influence their day-to-day life. So I feel like the shift moving towards presidential elections is what's ruining our republic.
James, thanks very much for that comment. Eric Metaxas, I wonder how you would react to James. Also, in light of the comment we got from Michael, who emailed, can someone please explain how the role and presence of the Electoral College in our electoral process is consistent with or supports the definition of a republic read at the beginning of this segment? So, Eric, what about that focus on national politics, namely the presidency, as opposed to smaller, more local politics?
It's a fantastic point. And it really underscores the idea that government really is meant to be first local. We're supposed to govern ourselves. And the growth of the federal government is a parallel to the growth of the media culture. Imagine 100 years ago, nobody could be tuned to MSNBC or to CNN or to Fox News. Everything had to be, roughly speaking, localized. There was something really healthy about that, just as it's healthy to have a separation of powers. The more levels you have, sort of like as baffles, protect us from these gigantic trends. So when everybody's watching TV and talking about the same thing, it becomes fundamentally unhealthy, because the founders understood that self-government means, first and foremost, I govern me. I govern myself. I worry about my family. I worry about my community. That's the way it was supposed to work. And when we kind of turn things over to the federal level, when we turn things over to what are the media pundits saying, something shifts. And that's something that I think has taken us away from the founders' vision, because at the heart of it all, I need to get to this, was their idea of virtue. Every one of them, and these were not all, you know, theologically orthodox Christians of any kind, but every one of them understood that self-government implies virtue. People have to govern themselves, and they all said that if that's not part of the conversation, the whole thing will fall apart. What's the last time we talked about virtue in public schools? We don't do that anymore.
Michael, how do you see it?
Well, a couple of responses. I would say, first of all, that, you know, the federal government did not impose itself on the citizens of this country for no reason or just for kicks. The federal government grew because of very clear and substantive concrete failures of local government, of state government, and of the private sector. I'm talking now about the stock market collapse and the Great Depression, and it was out of that that the modern federal state, as we know it, sort of grew. But you know, this didn't happen for no reason. You know, this was a time when it looked as if capitalism itself could collapse. And there was a dictatorship of the proletariat in the Soviet Union, and Adolf Hitler had just seized power a couple of months before Franklin Roosevelt became president. He hadn't quite established a dictatorship yet, but to people who understood things, it was clear it was headed in that direction. These were the kinds of pressures that the Roosevelt people were dealing with. They expanded the state, you know, not to get into people's lives. They expanded the state to save capitalism. That's the first point I'd make. Now, quickly, with respect to the Electoral College, the Electoral College is a very good example of the ways in which the founders didn't trust regular people to make decisions. And remember, by regular people, they meant propertied white men only. They didn't mean black people and women and others. They meant propertied white men, but they didn't even trust them to make the right decision when it came to the president. And the electors, as they conceived it, were entirely supposed to take matters into their own hands if they felt the people of their state made a mistake. So the Electoral College is undemocratic, and it's one of those things that should change. And I believe founders would agree that it should change. And I think we honor them more by looking at them and what they did realistically They said, you know, Jefferson said there could be a revolution every 15 years. They were all supportive of change.
Can I just throw in a little bit more about the Electoral College? Alexander Hamilton wrote about the Electoral College in the Federalist Papers number 68. He said that the electors would be, and I'm quoting from Hamilton, quote, men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to govern their choice, unquote. He also said that a successful candidate for president would have to have qualities to appeal to electors from many states. And this is how Hamilton put it, quote, talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity may alone suffice to elevate a man to the first honors in a single state, but it will require other talents and a different kind of merit to establish him in the esteem and confidence of the whole Union, or of so considerable a portion of it as would be necessary to make him a successful candidate for the distinguished office of the President of the United States. He also expressed confidence that, quote, it will not be too strong to say that there will be a constant probability of seeing the station filled by characters preeminent for ability and virtue, unquote. That's from the Federalist Papers number 68, written by Alexander Hamilton. Let's get back to some of your comments. Shane from Little Rock, Arkansas, left this in our inbox.
I'm 65 years old. I'm calling from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I've never seen the division in our country so perfectly mirrored before. I have siblings who are Trump supporters. I've been a lifelong progressive. And I know that we both have a passion and a love for this country that actually mirrors each other. So if we want to keep this republic, we've got to begin to dialogue on all the ways that we're the same. I think Clinton had it right when he said that our similarities far outnumber our differences. And if we could begin to find out where we're so similar, we'd be surprised. At the end of the day, we'd just go bowling and forget about the arguing.
I hear that, Shane, and 100% behind you on finding more ways that we're alike than we are divided. That's one of the core tenets of this program, after all. Eric Metaxas, I'd love to get your reactions from Shane on today's political tribalism.
Well, first of all, congratulations to Shane for saying something so unifying, because I have to say, people on both sides of the aisle seem to think it's fun to demonize the other side. I really don't understand why we cannot respectfully disagree. And to me, when you hear people like Christian Amanpour even say, no, we've come to a point where we, in the world of journalism, now we have to be advocates for a point of view because we've crossed some line with the election of Donald Trump. I say to that, that is very destructive. We have to work hard. This is a time for us to work hard. If you hate Trump, you have to be honest with yourself and say, can I dare to praise him when he does something right? If I can't, I'm contributing to the problem. And I say this to people on both sides. We've come to a place where we feel like we're being virtuous by demonizing those on the other side. And so what the guest just said, it's wonderful. We ought to have friends on both sides, and we ought to try to appreciate that everyone who voted for Trump is not a racist. When you say things like that, when Kamala Harris says things like, I think Trump is a racist, I think it is destructive to all of America. It is very harmful, and we've come to that place, and we all need to be honest about it.
Well, I think we should be clear, and Michael, I will give you a chance to respond, that American media have been polarized since before this country was a republic. I mean, we used to be a nation of many, 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 many newspapers that were just kind of choose your own perspective that never had a lot of crossover. And to be fair, it's not just Senator Kamala Harris that has called President Trump a racist, for example. His former attorney, Michael Cohen, is also calling the president a racist. So this, the perspective's a little bit different than I think you just described, just to be clear.
I don't think there's anything wrong with calling Donald Trump a racist, if that's what you think. There's something wrong with saying everybody who voted for Trump is a racist. There's certainly something wrong with saying that, but there's nothing wrong with calling Trump a racist. And this, you're right, Joshua, this has gone on forever. In the campaign of 1800, let me make sure I have it right. It was Jefferson's people who called Adams a man of hermaphroditical character.
I think you're right. Yeah, I'm going to confirm that. But
it wasn't Adams to Jefferson. It was the Jeffersonians to Adams. That was a horribly, horribly contentious, awful, ugly contest, 1800, one of the worst in our history. And, you know, you talk about Twitter. Twitter existed then, basically, in the form of the pamphlets, the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist pamphleteers who are out agitating either for or against passage of the Constitutional Convention. Like people on Twitter today, they didn't even have to use their real names. There was this guy Brutus, who was an anti-federalist pamphleteer of particularly incendiary opinions. People didn't know his real name, but he said all kinds of things. This has always existed, but we've managed our way through it. Why is the question, and how do we get back to managing our way through it?
I just want to confirm what you just said, Michael. It was indeed the election of 1800, which is noted in the musical Hamilton. Adams, who was the incumbent, was running against Thomas Jefferson. Neither of them came out looking particularly dignified. James Thompson Callender was a journalist who Jefferson allegedly hired to write nasty things about Adams, and Callender published an attack on Adams in which he called John Adams, quote, a hideous hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman, unquote. There's the election of 1800 for you. Let's get to another voicemail from one of our listeners about the current state of the Republic. Here's what June left in our inbox.
With the prevalence of social media, my concern is that we are becoming a society of folks who are constantly looking over our shoulders, monitoring both the good and the bad things that we post or speak. Once planted, much of our social media cannot be undone, remaining forever in cyberspace. In some ways, it's starting to feel more like Big Brother is watching.
I hear you on that, June. Thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Eric Michael alluded to the impact of social media a moment ago. What would you, Eric, say to June's comment?
Well, I agree with what June just said. I mean, look, just because people in 1800 behaved like jackasses doesn't mean it's a good thing to behave like a jackass. And I think when you have vicious people like Brutus, you know, 219 years ago saying what he said, to say, well, because they behaved like that, there's nothing new. Let me say, since the beginning of this republic, civility and graciousness were virtues that were necessary to the republic. If everybody behaved like Brutus and like the vulgar people on Twitter, this republic would go down in flames way more quickly than we think it's going down in flames. We have to have civility, and we have to balance self-criticism with applauding ourselves for when we get it right. When people talk about loving America, it doesn't mean America love it or leave it, but it means we have to celebrate what is beautiful and true and good about this nation. We've stopped doing that. If we can't tell our kids this is the greatest nation in the world, not because of the blood that runs in my veins, but because the ideas that say we believe in freedom, we believe in opportunity for all, and even if we don't get it right, we believe in these things and we're going to keep trying to make it better and better. We have to be able to do that and to have grace to people who differ as to how we get there. Otherwise, we're going to have ugliness to the horizon, and we're never going to keep the republic.
Well, I hear you on that. I do recall, though, that there have been duels on the floor of Congress before. So civility has usually been a core value. There have been a few moments where it's gotten really, really crazy, and thankfully we don't do that anymore. And I know we got to pause in a minute, but I hear you when you say that we have to be able to hold up the virtues of this country, but not all Americans grew up in a country that treated them with virtue. I think the experiences of many people of color in this country, of LGBTQ people in this country, of tribal people in this country, of Muslims in this country, of women in this country, have been that this is not a country that was built for them in any way. So I understand you saying that they should be willing to say that, but some of them literally can't because they've never seen it.
Well, I mean, are they seeing it today? I believe that we elected an African-American president. Am I getting that right?
That does not excuse everything that happened before and after Barack Obama.
Of course it doesn't. But if we cannot celebrate ourselves when we do good things like that, we're fools. We know that – I mean, look, I had a man on my radio program the other day whose grandfather was lynched in 1935 in the South. I get this. And this man wrote a book called Cry Like a Man. He talks about how do we process in a healthy way the evil that has been done. It's important for us to deal with the fact that these things happened. But the question is, how do we move forward in a way that is healthy and that does not keep saying we're never going to get it right? We stink. We've never done it right. We've gotten a lot of stuff right. And the fact that, you know, we had Jim Crow and now we don't, we need to understand we are moving in a good direction. And just because we're not there yet doesn't mean we shouldn't be happy that we've made some progress.
And I do want to talk about how we move forward from there when we continue. Michael, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I'll be as quick as I can. I mean, we do celebrate as a people our accomplishments and our advances. I think it's wrong to say that we don't. You know, when Obama was elected, many, many millions of Americans were enthralled and recognized that, whether they loved Obama or maybe didn't, they recognized that for the landmark that it was. And many people do civic things every day that we never hear about because they don't make the papers, because they don't produce conflict, that celebrate this country. There are many, many Muslim American community organizations out there that are trying to instruct people in living up to the best ideals of what it is to be an American, the ideals that Eric spoke of at the top of the show. That all goes on in this country. You know, this country is not Twitter. It's not jerks on Twitter. This country's full.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, this country is full of people doing amazing civic-minded things that just don't get attention. So that's point number one. Point number two, very quickly, we celebrate our advancements, but we worry about and we protest the ways in which it seems to a lot of people that we're going backwards. Schools in this country, public schools, are resegregating at a very, very alarming rate and have been for the last 15 or 20 years. And they're not resegregating because somebody sprinkled resegregation pixie dust on them. They're resegregating because of the Supreme Court, because of courts, because of decisions that are made by particular jurists. So if people want to fight the fact of those jurists getting on benches, they should do that. They should fight it.
Let me get to a few more of your comments before we keep going. Joanna wrote on our website, the1a.org, I agree that a virtuous citizenry is required to make a good democratic government, but I see no, and that's small d, democratic government, but I see no evidence that practitioners of Judaism and Christianity have a monopoly on virtues such as honesty, humility, mercy, generosity, justice, equity, frugality, and peace. I am a Christian. I wish my co-religionists would put more energy into care for the least of these and would stop trying to claim all virtue and arrogate all power for ourselves. That last little bit is a reference to a Bible verse in which Jesus says, that which you do for the least of these, you do also unto me. Mariana emailed, it feels easy for some of the commentators to praise trying to see civil discourse as the way forward. However, there are disenfranchised and marginalized groups on one side whose very lives are threatened and do not have the luxury of opinions in this conversation. HC emailed, it's time for a constitutional convention to inspect and revise the founding document, to reconsider the Electoral College, abolishing the U.S. Senate, protection of voting rights, getting money out of politics, and other reforms. Reforming government, and particularly as it relates to money in politics, came up in more than one of our comments, including this one that landed in our inbox.
My name is Gary from Oklahoma. I think our founding fathers would be very upset with the state of our country just because of lobbying. To me, in some regards, lobbying is, you know, good for, you know, women's rights, special interest in that regard, and maybe in even the environment. But more often than not, people with money more or less bribe our government officials in order to, you know, get their own interests. And I don't think that's really right. And I would really wish in general that somehow this gets changed up.
Gary, thanks very much for your comment. We've had a number of conversations on this program about how lobbying works and the influence of lobbyists. You'll find those online. Just search lobbying on the1a.org. Eric, how would you respond to Gary, the impact of lobbying and money in politics for the state of our republic?
Well, I don't have a lot to say on that, except that I agree. It's sickening. And, you know, again, this is one of these weird things. Trump had some things that he did right in the beginning of his presidency dealing with lobbyists. And I was like on my chair applauding. I thought, my goodness, how wonderful that he has done this. But what I really have to say, though, is to get back to the woman who talked about virtue and faith and saying that the Christians and Jews aren't the only ones with virtue. Mm-hmm. I applaud that as well. That is 100%. It's so accurate. Any of us who's a Christian knows that Christians get stuff wrong and that atheists get things right. This has never been a question of that. The founders said that they observed that when religion broke out, when George Whitefield's preaching Jesus across the colonies and revival strikes, they observed that virtue increased, crime went down. In other words, it doesn't mean that you have to be a Christian to have virtue. And so anybody who thinks that that's what Christians are saying has to understand, no Christian that I know is saying that, absolutely not. But I do think the founders said that virtue is something that has to be taught. And when you're talking about the least of these, I mean, I'll give you an example. The other day, we are so divided that the Congress could not pass a bill that said when a child is born alive, that its life needs to be preserved. I said to myself, what has happened to America? We once had bipartisan consensus that when a child is viable, that we would take care of it. This has nothing to do with Roe v. Wade, nothing to do with reproductive rights. We are so divided now that when you talk about the least of these, I think about those babies. And I think that if we on the Democratic side, for example, cannot say that this is wrong, we are so divided that it really does become hopeless.
Michael, could I ask you to respond to the part of Gary's comment about lobbying and the influence of money in politics?
Yeah, well, it's incredibly corrosive, and it's undemocratic, and I'm sorry to say, Gary, likely to get much worse before it gets better.
Although the courts have said that it is democratic, that the way you spend your money politically is an expression that's protected by the First Amendment.
Yes, they did in 1976.
And even in Citizens United, Citizens United won that case, is that if you tell Citizens United you're not allowed to spend private money to make a political statement, you have to apply that to every other private organization that spends money to make political statements, like the Washington Post in its opinion page, or like MSNBC with, you know, left-wing commentators. Like, money is protected by the First Amendment as political expression.
It is. And, the Supreme Court said it. So, you know, who am I next to the Supreme Court? I disagree with it. And many, many, many experts do disagree with it. What they did in 1976 was they said you can a candidate can spend as much as they want because spending is speech. But they kept contribution limits on. What many people fear this Supreme Court that we have now is going to do is find a case to do away with contribution limits. And in that case, you know, anybody can just buy a member of Congress by themselves. As for lobbying, the caller's right, of course. It's awful. And it's something that, you know, corporate America didn't even do in the 60s or 70s. And then they started to see that, well, boy, we can get something out of this if we spend some money. Now, it's true, as the caller said, that environmental groups lobby and women's groups lobby and everybody lobbies. But like 90% of the lobbying money is spent by banks and corporations.
Brad emailed, the sentiment that we need to focus on our similarities and not our differences is a disastrous privilege of the middle and upper class. How can you ask someone to put aside their differences and go bowling, as was suggested, when one group literally believes the other to be less than human and undeserving of equal rights? How can separating families and locking up children be a mere difference of opinion? Tony emailed, I believe the idea that a citizen should vote in their own interest is a big problem. We should vote for and in the interest of the republic. What is good for us, first locally, then statewide, and finally nationally. That's a unifying force that we need in order to be truly American. A republic is, of course, a representative government. So if we're not active in picking our representatives to a high enough degree, maybe it's our fault.
The idea of virtue. I mentioned it earlier. The reason I said the founders saw it as utterly vital and crucial is because if people only vote their self-interest selfishly, and they say, okay, this party or this candidate is going to give me what I want. I'm going to get, you know, let's say free this and free that or whatever on both sides of the aisle. Once that happens, you're not voting, just as the caller said, for America, for what's good for America. In order to vote for what's good for America, to some extent, you have to put yourself aside and you have to do the virtuous thing. And you say, even though, let's say I'm going to make less money or the tax situation here is not going to help me, I need to do what is right. If we don't understand that as Americans, then things fall apart. And I think when we get into this divided time and when we get into identity politics and this kind of thing, it exacerbates what the founders said cannot happen. If this happens and if people are just voting for themselves, we are no different than a third world banana republic. We become something that the founders said is no longer the America that they hoped to give us.
I think maybe though on the flip side, Michael, there is the aspect of the way that we vote, and a number of our listeners had issues with the system itself. Here's another voicemail from our inbox.
Hello, this is Peter from Spring, Texas, and I live in Texas District 2, and it's one of the severely gerrymandered districts that has a shape that defies description. I think gerrymandering and voter suppression are two issues that have me very concerned.
Peter, thanks for calling in. I just Googled the shape of the district. It looks like the top of the city of Houston. Springs sits just north of Houston. Like if you put a shower cap on the head of Houston and the top of it started to kind of come out because there's too much steam under it, that's what this district looked like. It is not any kind of Euclidean geometric shape. So, Michael, I hear, you know, Paul about voter involvement, but voters have said there are some issues with the system in which they are involved.
Well, there are. And I write a lot about this in the book, and the first chapter of my book is dedicated to this whole question of why we have single-member districts, which a lot of other countries, most other democracies, don't have. I go into the whole history of it. But I talk about gerrymandering as well in the book, and we really have to do something about that. We're moving in a decent direction on that in some states. Some states are appointing these commissions to draw districts rather than let the legislatures do them. That's all good. But it's a serious problem. What gerrymandering has produced on both sides, but more on the Republican side, the facts are plain, is that they've created districts where people don't have to worry about a general election anymore. All they have to worry about is, am I going to be challenged in a primary if I bolt from the party line? If I cast a bad vote, a bad quote-unquote, you know, party non-party line vote, I'm going to get a primary. And I don't want to go through the hassle of having to raise all that money and having to run against somebody and facing a primary. They never worry about a general election anymore. That is one particular thing that must be fixed.
I know we're low on time. Last question for both of you. The statement from Ben Franklin was, a republic if we can keep it. Eric Metaxas, very, very briefly, do you think we're going to keep it?
Well, he said, if you can keep it, which is the title of my book. And I'll tell you right now, I do. And the reason I believe we can keep it is because I think the founders, if they could wake up today and see what we have, as horrified as they would also be astounded that 243 years later, we are still here. None of the founders really believed that that was possible. I think that they were hoping and praying, but I think that if we keep fixing things, gerrymandering needs to be fixed. Money in politics needs to be fixed. I think the idea of abolishing the Electoral College is a terrible idea because it leads to mob rule, but there's all kinds of things we can debate and get right. And the reason I wrote my book is because I believe if we don't take this seriously, we won't keep it. So I'm positive, but we have work to do.
Briefly, Michael, can we keep it?
Yes, provided. Here's something we haven't spent too much time talking about. Economics. We had a country at its best, at its peak, that provided for the general prosperity, as I said at the top of this segment, for almost everybody. We need that again. We need that. If we have well-shared prosperity, a lot of these other divisions, the temperature will lower on these things. But we need everybody to feel that they're getting their slice of the pie.
Michael Tomasky, editor-in-chief of Democracy Journal, special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. His book is called If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. Michael, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
And Eric Metaxas, author of If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty, and the host of The Eric Metaxas Show. Thanks, Eric.
You guys are swell. Keep it up.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.